I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition and liftoff of NASA's New Horizons spacecraft on a decade-long voyage to visit the planet Pluto and then beyond.
That was New Horizons, a 1,000-pound spacecraft being sent into space on January 19, 2006, heading for Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, 3 billion miles away, the farthest trip ever attempted. It's been sending back data, and in the summer of 2015, in a flyby of Pluto, it sent back extraordinary photographs. This mission began almost 20 years ago and almost didn't get off the ground because of battles with NASA and what it took to design, build, and launch an outer planet spacecraft. Our guest planetary scientist Alan Stern is the principal of the New Horizons mission and has co-authored a new book with astrobiologist David Grinspoon titled Chasing New Horizons, and they both join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Alan Stern, nice to have you with us.
Very nice to be here, Marty.
And David Grinspoon, nice to have you with us as well.
Thanks a lot. I'm happy to be here.
Alan, does that take you back listening to that liftoff?
It really does.
What, 12, 13 years ago?
Yeah, a dozen years ago, and a big day for us.
I understand that instead of, I guess, watching this on a computer, you actually had to go out and actually see this with your own eyes?
Yeah, I was in the Launch Control Center, and when we got right down to the 1098, you know, I thought, I've worked on this for 17 years, and I am not going to watch this on a TV screen. I want to see it for myself.
So what did you see?
So it's quite impressive. The launch vehicle, it's called an Atlas V, and it is the size of a downtown skyscraper here in Philadelphia, 224 feet tall,
wow.
Generating 2 million pounds of thrust, and it leapt off the launch pad. Imagine a downtown building just going vertically upward, 10,000 feet in about 15 seconds, went supersonic in half a minute. The sound is just unbelievable. If you've never been to one of these rocket launches, it's like being on a front row of a rock and roll concert in terms of the bass.
It's that loud.
It's loud, a lot of bass, things are shaking. It's really a lot of fireworks, very impressive. And, of course, our baby was, you know, on it, and we only had one, not two, so it had to work.
Yeah.
And it was really a pleasure to get to watch it soar up all the way to space, you know, with my own eyes.
Well, David, let's talk about this baby, 1,000 pounds. There's some really fascinating pictures in this book of what it looks like. On the one hand, it looks kind of simple, but obviously it can't be. What do we need to know about New Horizons?
Well, compared to other planetary spacecraft, in a way, I wouldn't call it simple, but it's sort of stripped down. It took a lot of ingenuity for the team to fit this spacecraft into all the constraining boxes. They had to do it for, you know, really not very much money considering what was being attempted. And it had to be very small, not very much mass, because when you're launching something to go 3 billion miles away, you need to put a small spacecraft on a big rocket. And, you know, it was the fastest launch off of Earth ever. And so they had to solve problems by making things small and engineering in very clever ways. So it's sort of stripped down, but it's very powerful because the instruments on board are just designed so that, you know, when you got one chance to go to this new planet that's never been seen before and you don't know when, if ever, you're going to be back, you want to take as much data as you can. So they're it's small, but it's packed with a lot of scientific firepower.
I see a heat shield. I see thrusters. I see star trackers. I also see Ralph and Alice. The Cramdons went on board.
The honeymooners, absolutely. Yeah, those are two of the primary scientific instruments. They were actually one scientific instrument combined together. And when, for engineering reasons, it made more sense to split them up, we thought we'd name them after the Cramdons.
Going, at least at launch, 36,000 miles an hour? Did I read that right?
That's right. That's right. You know, Apollo missions launched at very high speed as well, taking crews of three people to the moon. It took them about 3 days. New Horizons did that in 9 hours flat.
Wow. Yeah. And what about now? Do we know how fast?
Oh, we absolutely know how fast. We measure that speed all the time. And the spacecraft is traveling about 32,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
So it's traveling the better part of 1 million miles every day.
And David, where is New Horizons as we speak?
So it made it past Pluto on Bastille Day 2015, and it kept going to this. It's on its way to another object out in the Kuiper Belt, the farthest object that we will ever have seen in photographs. You know, even a billion miles past Pluto, which is, you know, sort of hard to comprehend, but it's on its way there. And it's the Kuiper Belt is this whole new realm of the solar system that we didn't even know about until the 1980s, really. And it turns out that our solar system, beyond the inner planets like the Earth and the outer, what we used to call the outer planets like Jupiter, has this whole other realm of smaller objects, of which Pluto is the largest one, and it's this real terra incognita. So New Horizons is working its way out through the Kuiper Belt now, and of course, eventually will leave the solar system entirely and be the fifth human-made spacecraft to leave our sun's gravity and travel through the galaxy.
And this thing, I don't even know what to call it, Alan. It's what, January 1st, 2019?
That's right. Yeah, New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
And what is this? I guess it's a flyby, right?
Yeah, we're making another flyby, but of a much smaller object. You know, Pluto's got about the surface area, the same surface area as the continental United States, so it's fast. But this this target, which has the name Ultima Thule, which is Norse for beyond the farthest frontier. Uh-huh. Kind of cool.
Yeah, that is kind of cool.
You know, it's small. It's about the size of the metropolitan area here. And it's a typical building block out of which the small planets like Pluto were made. And so we want to understand the origin of these small planets. So we're going to what they're made out of. Wow. Ultima is our target. It's about 30 kilometers across. That's about 20 miles. It may be a binary, meaning two like-sized things that are orbiting one another. We don't know a lot about it, but we're going to learn a tremendous amount as New Horizons flashes by during New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
Well, shortly after liftoff, Pluto got, and I'm using quotations here, demoted. How do you feel about that, Alan?
Well, you know, it really didn't get demoted. Some people in another field, not experts in planetary science, astronomers, and people in a neighboring field of study, stars and galaxies, were concerned that school children couldn't keep track of large numbers of planets that were being discovered. So they thought they would
really? You think that? I mean, that?
No, honestly, that was the motivation.
That's what they said.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And so they thought they would limit the number of planets by excluding one of the biggest discoveries in my career. During my career, I didn't make that discovery, but it's been discovered that the solar system is littered with lots of small planets the size of continents on the Earth. And they're big, they're round. If you saw them on the viewfinder of the Starship Enterprise, the first thing you'd think is there's a planet. Now, experts in planetary science never made such a proclamation. We've always considered what we call the dwarf planets, still planets. And, you know, the sun is technically called a dwarf star. We don't consider it not a star. But ever since then, because the press of the day back in 2006 just sort of accepted that without thinking about it, didn't even come ask planetary scientists, really. We've been having this conversation over and over. And, you know, the book is a platform for actually talking about the fact that the solar system is littered with small planets. Pluto's the largest of the ones that we know so far. They're probably going to be ridiculous number of them in the end, just like there are, who knows, all the mountains of the Earth or all the rivers of the Earth, right, or all the stars in the sky. But we don't not call them mountains or rivers just so that we can memorize their names.
So small planet doesn't mean less than.
That's right.
Well, and in fact, we discovered by exploring this particular small planet, Pluto, that it's far from less than, in that it's really genuinely one of the most interesting places in the solar system in terms of what we discovered about the nature of the planet. It's, you know, it's so complex and, you know, active and fascinating that, you know, it seems even more ridiculous after we've been there to not consider it a planet.
Well, what do we know? What have we learned from New Horizons then about Pluto? Alan, if I can go back to you and then David, I'll get you in on
it. Well, before New Horizons arrived, we only had telescopic observations and Pluto was just more or less a dot in the distance. But we knew that it was covered in ices, that it has five moons, that it had strong surface markings, but not much else, really not much else. And we knew that it had an atmosphere. But now, after New Horizons, we know that it has glaciers that flow on its surface. It's very likely to have a planet-wide ocean in its interior, that it has mountain ranges the size of the Rockies and the height of the Rockies and with snow-capped mountains. It's an amazing place. There are avalanches that happen there. There are big ravines and canyons, very old and very young terrains. It's clear that Pluto's geological engine is still ticking away like the Earth's and Mars and making new terrains all the time. It snows there. It may rain
snow
there from time to time.
Snow that we would recognize as snow?
As white fluffy stuff, but it's made of nitrogen, not water ice. And big climate cycles, weather, hazes in the atmosphere, and the five moons are fascinating too. You know, New Horizons conducted over 450 different observations with the cameras and spectrometers of Pluto and each of those moons, and really wrote the textbook about what these dwarf planets are all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because Pluto wasn't quote-unquote discovered, David, until, 1930?
Yeah, that's right. And the story of Pluto's discovery is really a cool one, and we tell that in the book too. And one thing that's neat about it is it wasn't that long ago. Clyde Tombaugh is the American astronomer who discovered Pluto, and it was discovered in 1930, so people are still alive who were alive when Pluto was discovered. And Clyde Tombaugh is just this sort of classic American story, growing up in the Depression on a farm in Kansas, was fascinated with the sky and built his own telescopes, and whenever there was downtime from helping out on the farm, would be out at night sketching Mars, and had this fantasy of being an astronomer, but he had no idea of how he would ever afford to go to college or do what it takes to become a professional astronomer. But he would make these wonderful sketches and mail them off to observatories. And then one day he got a letter back from the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, saying, "We're impressed with your sketches. Would you like a job as an assistant?"
Such a great story. But he saw something that was 3 billion miles away.
Yeah, I mean, and then he gets to Flagstaff and the observatory, and he spends over a year of this painstaking night after night quest to photograph something moving in the right way in the outer solar system. And a lot of people told him, you know, it was futile. And he didn't give up. And then in early 1930, he caught it. Huh. And there's a little dot moving against the background stars in just the right way. And then he went back and checked and made sure. And then he went to, you know, down. He was, for a few minutes, the only person on Earth that knew about this planet. And then he went and told his observatory director, "Hey, I found your planet X you've been searching for," you know. And then, of course, he is now in the history books. And,
absolutely.
One thing.
You know what? Hold on to that thought, only because they're playing my song here, and we're going to take a very short break. That's David Grinspoon, who joins us along with Alan Stern. They've got a new book, Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with our guests about New Horizon. That's a spaceship that launched in 2006 to visit tiny Pluto at the edge of our solar system. This is a plutonium-powered spacecraft, traveled 3 billion miles over 9 years, actually zooming past Pluto in 2015, taking photographs. We've been talking about what we're learning about Pluto with our guests Alan Stern and David Grinspoon, again, authors of this new book called Chasing New Horizon, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Any Pluto questions, also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, we were talking about this American, I guess, farmer, amateur scientist discovering Pluto in 1930. And Alan, going back to you, there are some ashes of this man inside New Horizon as it hurtles into outer space.
Right. That's absolutely right. Before he died in the late 1990s, he had said that if a spacecraft mission is ever sent to Pluto, he would like to have his ashes on board.
Oh, wow.
And so when we were getting close to launch, I contacted his widow, Patsy Tombaugh, and asked if the family was still interested in that, and in fact, if we could do that for them. And they were very excited about it, and they made it possible. We built a little container that was mounted on the spacecraft, put a little plaque next to it about who he was, and launched Clyde to his own planet, and now flying out of the solar system, the first human remains to be sent out into the galaxy.
And there's a note that you wrote that goes along with it.
There is. It just a few sentences about his history.
This is a spacecraft powered by plutonium.
Right, the element named after the planet Pluto.
I get that. But plutonium, is that a hard source of, what, energy to power a spacecraft?
So
this is Alan Stern.
Yeah, this is the power source that NASA has used for decades for spacecraft that go so far from the sun that you can't use solar power. The plutonium, as it decays, generates heat, and the heat can be used to generate electricity. The whole spacecraft runs on about 200 watts, about three light bulbs worth of power for all the propulsion, guidance, computer systems, all the scientific sensors. The whole kit and caboodle runs on about the same as three light bulbs generated by that plutonium.
That's incredible. And I know there's a hibernation part of this as well. David, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, it was one of the innovations that was created to solve the somewhat unique problems of sending a spacecraft that far, a spacecraft that would have to travel for 9 years from launch in 2006 to flyby of Pluto in 2015, and indeed is now traveling for more years and many more miles. But, you know, how do you deal with that and try to keep the project manageable, because it takes a lot of people to run a spacecraft, and it's, you don't want the spacecraft to sort of wear out over that time. So what they realized was they could sort of put the spacecraft to sleep for long periods during that cruise out to Jupiter, and then the much longer cruise out to Pluto after the gravity slingshot past Jupiter. Mm. And so by doing that, you make it simpler to run from the ground, because the spacecraft is basically almost everything shut down. It's just sending a beacon once a week to say, I'm still here, I'm fine. And then every once in a while you wake it up and, you know, do more thorough checkouts and course corrections and so forth. But while it's hibernating, it doesn't take much work from the ground. And it also sort of saves the wear and tear on the spacecraft. You know, Alan describes it as, you know, if you bought a television in the year 2000 and you wanted to, there's a show you wanted to watch on it, you know, in 2015, you don't leave it on the whole time. You know, you turn it, you leave
something
it off.
Something we can all relate
yeah,
to.
Yeah, so it doesn't wear out. And it works really well. And, you know, they had to sort of learn how to hibernate it first, and they'd put it to sleep for, you know, a few days and then a week and then a month. But by the end, they got really good at it. And so the team could focus on other things, like planning the flyby of Pluto, which was a complex task.
Well, you're the mission leader, Alan Stern. But how many people would you say have worked on and probably still continue to be involved in this New Horizon mission?
Yeah, well, there's actually two answers to that question, because when we were in the early years preparing to fly it, during the design phase and construction and testing, there were quite literally 2,500 people on the project.
Wow.
To build the spacecraft, build a rocket, build the nuclear power supply, all the scientific sensors. But after we launched, we didn't need that big team. There was nothing left to build, nothing left to design. We needed a flight control team and a science team and a few key lead engineers. And so the project shrunk dramatically. It went from like being in a big city to being in a small town with just a few dozen people to run the entire mission ever since 2006 when we launched it.
Well, I do want to play a clip, and this is another clip that we found, and this is a New Horizons spacecraft. Spacecraft, quote-unquote, phoning home. This is July 14th, 2015, indicating a successful completed flyby of Pluto. These are the team members at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, and you will hear them cheering as they receive this confirmation.
Mom, this is Thermal on Pluto 1.
Go ahead, Thermal.
Thermal reports nominal. All temperatures green.
Copy that. Thermal is nominal. All temperatures green. PI, Mom on Pluto 1. We have a healthy spacecraft. We've recorded data of the Pluto system, and we're outbound for Pluto.
Yeah. That's
it. And then we see Alan Stern bursting through the door and cheering.
Yeah. I couldn't resist. I was next door in the next room watching Mission Control through a big glass window with the head of NASA, the head of NASA's science programs, and the head of NASA's planetary exploration program. And you heard Alice Bowman, our mission operations manager, announcing the success. And when she looked at me, and we were really doing this, and after all these years that we'd worked on it, I just needed to go in the room and actually give her a big hug. And it was quite a moment.
And what does the mom refer to?
Oh, it stands for Mission Operations Manager, and everything's an abbreviation,
right?
So it's the mom. And even in our line of work, even men who are Mission Operations Managers are referred to as the mom.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the fact, David, that there were some serious glitches, I guess, in that losing contact with New Horizons as this Pluto approached.
Yeah, it was by no means a sure thing that this was all going to work. In fact, you know, there's so many times that it could have failed that it when you read the whole story and tell the whole story, it feels sort of miraculous that it worked. And I have to say, when you play that clip that you just played of the phone home moment, I don't know if you can see here in the studio, but I get a tear.
Oh, I didn't see that.
In my eye, and I still choke up about that moment because that was the aftermath of it was so fraught in so many ways. And about a week before that, after the 9-year journey to Pluto, and when the spacecraft was barreling in for its final approach, there was a huge moment of potential catastrophe when they lost contact with the spacecraft completely.
Just as it was approaching.
Yeah.
Of all times.
Yeah.
The worst possible time.
Yeah. And you know, so first, they didn't know if they would hear from it ever again, and there's that, you know, that real fear of, like, did something go wrong? Did we hit something? You know, is it lost? And then when they fortunately hear back from it, they realize that the spacecraft is in a state where it can't execute the flyby because files have been lost, and there's not much time. And especially at this point, it's so far from Earth that it takes 4.5 hours for a signal, so that's 9-hour round trip. It takes 9 hours just to say, hey, are you okay? And the spacecraft send back, yeah, what should I do? You know, and so there was a very critical and difficult effort to get it back on track. And people were, you know, pulling all-nighters and sleeping on the floor. And it was right after the July 4th holiday, so people were coming in their shorts and flip-flops and, you know, solving this crisis. And it was a moment when the team was really tested. And ultimately, with just hours to spare, they got everything fixed so that they could execute the flyby correctly.
Alan, was the glitch on Earth, the glitch with New Horizons, or?
The problem was we overtaxed the spacecraft. We asked it to do too many things. It's an interesting story, actually. The spacecraft was at that time programmed to be doing some data compression, just like your phone would do to reduce the amount of memory needed to store some images. And at the same time, the computer program that would run it all through the flyby, all the complex instructions for the close flyby was being received by the radio communication system, and it was writing that to the flash memory on board the spacecraft computer. Turns out that the combination of those two things overtaxed the computer. Uh-huh. And you might think, wouldn't you practice that, you know, beforehand? You know, how dumb are these guys? We had practiced that a lot. We have an actual spacecraft simulator that has all the same electronics on board in a room. And we run all of the things we're going to do on the spacecraft on that before we send it up. But the difference was when we tested that, the images that we used weren't as complex as Pluto turned out to be. So the computer had to work harder to do all these Fourier transforms in the JPEG compression. And it was operating much higher CPU cycles than we had predicted because Pluto turned out to be so complex. Wow. And that conspired with the storage of the command load for the flyby to overtax it. And there's a watchdog circuit in the computer that recognized it was overtaxed and basically shut it down. And that's when we lost communications and then started a process to bring up its backup. And
so it fixed itself in a way?
It recovered from the immediate, the actual proximate cause of the problem. But when it came up on the backup, all of the computer instruction files for navigating to Pluto, pointing at the planet, and all of the instructions for the flyby weren't on the backup side. And so, you know, it had taken us weeks to put all that up on the spacecraft, and suddenly here we were. That spacecraft was going to be at Pluto in 10 days. Whether we could get the job done of restoring all those files and getting back on the prime computer in time. And Allison and her team, it was very reminiscent of the movie Apollo 13 after the explosion.
Yeah, I can see this movie, actually.
And, you know, it wasn't as simple as just, you know, send it all back up again. We had to write completely new constructions and then test them on that simulator. And then once it worked, send them to the spacecraft in bite-sized steps and check that each step had worked with this 9-hour round-trip light time that David was talking about. I'll tell you, it would make a great movie.
Yeah, and how soon before you had this window to take photos of Pluto, how much time did you have?
So we had a nominal start, a planned start to the data taking, exactly 7 days before the flyby. And that's because Pluto takes about 7 days to turn once on its axis. And so when the malfunction occurred, we were 10 days out. Alice's team had 3 days to do all this, to figure it out, and to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And they got it done with 3.5 hours to spare.
That's amazing. Let me just read some comments here. An email from Robert. He says, Jupiter and Saturn have moons. Saturn has rings. There was a lot of interest around these planets. What's so special about exploring Pluto? I know you were waiting for this question. You're nodding your head, David. And Alan, I'll get you to weigh in as well.
Well, I mean, Jupiter
Why
and Saturn.
Why Pluto?
Yeah, I mean, Jupiter and Saturn, he's correct, are fascinating places. And they're very different kinds of planets than Pluto. And, you know, we're interested in the diversity of places in the solar system, just as Jupiter and Saturn were new from the inner planets like Venus and Mars that we had explored earlier. There was this whole other kind of planet we had never been to. And so we're interested in the variety. And indeed, what we learned was that this new kind of planet, an icy dwarf planet like Pluto, is every bit as interesting. I mean, you know, we had no idea. I mean, Alan was always saying, you know, we're going to find something wonderful there, but that was as specific as he could get, and indeed we did. And now we know what's wonderful about Pluto. It's vibrant and alive, and it has moons and an atmosphere, and you know, you name it. It's got all kinds of very interesting characteristics, and so it's just about, you know, expanding our knowledge of what kind of worlds are out there.
Sure, I guess why not Pluto, right?
Yeah. Well, let me add to that just a little bit. You know, in the early years of the space program, NASA sent probes to all of the close planets, the so-called terrestrial planets, the rocky planets. So Mars, Venus, Mercury, they were all explored in the very early years, the 60s and 70s when that began. And then as we developed our techniques, we were able to go much farther distances and go to the four giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And then there was little Pluto, kind of a misfit. Not a giant planet, not a rocky planet. Who the hell ordered that? You know, and we didn't think we were going to do a mission to Pluto because it kind of looked like a footnote. But then in the late 90s and early 2000s, as this third zone of the solar system, the Kuiper Belt, was being discovered, it was also discovered that the whole region is dotted with small planets like Pluto, and that there are more of them than the terrestrial rocky planets and the giant planets combined. So the National Academy of Sciences recognized that this new class of planet really merited exploring, and Pluto being the biggest, the brightest, the first discovered of the set, the most well-known, was the way that we should go about opening up that exploration.
You just had to get there in order to 3 billion
miles. It's a long
hike. It's a long hike. A tweet from Violetta. How do you take pictures when moving at that speed? Mm. Is that an issue, Alan?
Well, we don't fly as close as you might think. We have telephoto lenses, and we go by at high speed, and the spacecraft actually turns to track on the planet while it's taking those pictures so that they're perfectly sharp.
And what about space debris? Is that an issue, David?
Yeah, that actually became more of an issue while the spacecraft while New Horizons was on its way to Pluto, because two new moons of Pluto were discovered en route. So it turned out that Pluto has five moons. And when they figured that out, they started to think, well, what else might be orbiting around Pluto? And moons can generate rings. We see that around the giant planets that Voyager explored. And so when you see these moons, you wonder if there are other things in orbit around Pluto that you can't detect from so far away that could be a real threat to the spacecraft. And this was a real concern. And then, especially after the discovery of these new moons, there was a huge effort, a hazard avoidance effort, where people were taking images from giant telescopes on Earth, and then as the spacecraft approached the planet, taking images to look for debris around Pluto and doing all kinds of computer modeling for where the debris might be in Pluto's orbit or in its gravitational field, and even making complex contingency plans. Mm-hmm. So if at the last minute they discovered a threat, they could change the trajectory entirely. And so there was a huge amount of work that was done because of this very real concern that that there could be something there that, you know, you got to remember, at 30,000 miles per hour, something tiny the size of a grain of rice can, you know, hit you like heavy ordnance and can really do damage.
Well, very briefly. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say it was pretty exciting in the final weeks as we were closing in. We had four different flybys that were planned, and we didn't know which one we were going to pull off the shelf and send up to the spacecraft. So we're taking these images and looking for hazards, and right up to the last minute almost, uncertain about which plan we would execute. We ended up executing the best of them because we didn't find any hazards in our path, and thank goodness.
We are talking about a trip to Pluto and beyond. That's Alan Stern, principal investigator of the New Horizons mission. He's a planetary scientist. Also with us is David Grinspoon. He's an astrobiologist and a frequent advisor to NASA on space exploration strategy. They're co-authors of a new book called Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Alan Stern and David Grinspoon about New Horizons, what it took to get New Horizons off the ground and past Pluto and beyond, and what it's teaching us about outer solar systems and small planets. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Bill from Swarthmore. With our 7 and 9-year-old children, we look at images on the JPL and NASA websites. We are swept away with the science and beauty, the ice mountains, ice flows, hexagonal patterns, shadows, distance, and your teams working through the computer and communication problems and getting timing to the work. I mean, it's great that us on here on Earth can really track what's happening out there.
Yeah. Alan. And it's one of the best things about, I think, the NASA space program is that all of that data is available for everyone.
Yeah.
And the squiggly line stuff, the spectroscopy is not so understandable. The plasma physics data is not so understandable, but the images are just stunning, and yeah, they're available for people all around the world to gaze at and enjoy.
Also, a question from Keith. What does an astrobiologist do? That's for you, David.
Oh, yeah. So astrobiology is a relatively new field, but addressing some ancient questions. You know, basically, are we alone in the universe? Through the combined scientific efforts of many different fields, the name, as you can hear, combines astronomy and biology, but also earth sciences and other fields in a sort of scientific effort to look at what we know about life on Earth and try to understand, based on what we know about environments of other planets, where there could be life. So my angle on that is, mm-hmm, from planetary science, trying to use spacecraft to understand more about the environments out there in the solar system and where there might be habitable environments.
How did you get interested, Alan, in space exploration?
You know, I got hooked as a little kid.
Like a lot of people, you know, in your line of work.
Like a lot of people. I was swept off my feet by early rocket launches and the Apollo missions when I was a little boy, and watching people exploring the moon. I thought, I want to grow up and be a part of that. And I stuck with it. and it worked out.
Did you want to be an astronaut?
I did.
How far did you get?
All the way to finals. I found out that I'm very healthy and that I don't have any psychological problems.
That's good to know.
But I wasn't chosen, and that was disappointing. As a near miss. Later, I was selected to fly on a shuttle flight with my own experiment. But as it turned out, that didn't happen either for complex reasons. So I hope to fly in space on commercial launch vehicles to do research, probably beginning next year or in 2020.
Well, interesting. I know you're working with Jeff Bezos and a number of, I guess they're billionaires, but very wealthy people are getting interested in rocket launches and space exploration. Is that because NASA has cut back on a lot of their mission work?
I don't think so. It's really because space technology has now come to the level where it doesn't require very large governmental enterprises that individual companies can get involved too. And so the development of commercial spaceflight, I think, is really revolutionizing everything from Earth observations and our ability to communicate, worldwide internet, things like that, to tourism, for other people to be able to see the Earth that aren't professional astronauts and to go at prices that actually regular people can afford. And here are some very successful people in the business world like Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk,
right,
who really know how to create large-scale enterprises that are successful. And they've all reached the same conclusion, and so have others, that this is a new frontier for capitalism, that we can exploit the resources in space, that we can send people to space as a destination vacation to look back at the Earth and appreciate our planet, and that there's a lot of money to be made through surveillance of the Earth, its weather, agricultural patterns, and even commerce. And so I think the 21st century is going to be where Star Trek begins.
Well, it's interesting because the space program obviously began with sending people into space. You could only go so far. And then we've got New Horizons, which is almost 4 billion miles from space. And then we've got this new commercial venture, which is about sending people into space.
And
regular people.
That's right, like you and I. I'm going to do research in space. You would probably want to go more as a tourist, to take a look. Mm-hmm. What does it look like? What does my home planet look like?
Or as a radio journalist in space.
Yes, well, that would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would do that. But anyway, David, how did you get interested in this?
Well, you know, it almost sounds cliche, but like a lot of space scientists of my generation, I was just blown away by the Apollo landings when I was a kid. I was in fourth grade when Neil and Buzz walked on the moon, and I remember that moment as one of my earliest vivid memories, watching that on the grainy black and white TV, and that really did launch my interest, and it kept going. I was fascinated by the early planetary missions. You know, things were happening then in the 60s and 70s, the first missions to Mars and Venus and the first orbiter of Mars. And then, I was a teenager in 1976, the first the Viking landing on Mars, really exciting times. And I was also kind of a science fiction geek as a kid, and just the space was the future. And 2001, that movie, that was, I still think of that as the future. You know, something went wrong, the future didn't happen the way it was supposed to, but we're still working on it. So it was just the romance of space and what was happening at the time. So that a geeky kid, there was nothing else I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And Marty,
yeah.
David's a little too modest to say it, but it's a fact that his father's closest friend was Carl Sagan.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we had Uncle Carl in the house.
Oh, my goodness.
Bringing the latest pictures of Mars to show us on the – back then you couldn't pull it up on your phone. He showed up with an 8x10 glossy photograph, said, hey, look, our spacecraft just went to Mars. So that was pretty cool and pretty inspiring.
Oh, just Carl Sagan over for dinner, having a beer.
Well, it's funny because this New Horizons, which obviously is, ended up being successful. But, Alan, there were a lot of bumps along the way. One of the quotes in the book is if New Horizons had been a cat, it would have been dead a long time ago. NASA was on board, and then they were off board, and then they wanted to save money, and then they were interested in different planets. There were a lot of There was a lot of stopping and starting on this.
Yeah, yeah. That quote that you gave, you know, cats only get 9 lives, yeah. And it took about 12 attempts. And but people really stuck with it. Our team was very persistent, very determined. And every time we get knocked down, we just pull ourselves back up, brush ourselves off, and go at it another way until we succeeded. And I think the book really tells it very well. And, you know, it's an adventure story.
But were there times where you felt as if you were just fighting with NASA in order to get this thing going?
Not so much fighting with NASA as trying to find the right key to unlock the door to get the project funded. And it was eventually successful. And in fact, one of NASA's most successful, not only scientific missions, yeah. But most engaging from the standpoint of public interest.
There was Dan Golden headed up. Did he head it up or was – yeah, he headed up NASA, and his mantra was faster, better, cheaper. David, was that hard then for New Horizons to fit under that mantra?
Well, you know, the legacy of that is mixed because Dan Golden did take an interest in Pluto and take an interest in small missions and got NASA sort of on that track. But he also got so sort of obsessed with doing things in a small and cheap way that there were some sort of unrealistic expectations that in a way sent the people working on this down some blind alleys. the details are messy because there were a lot of efforts that got derailed. But Dan Golden was a big booster of Pluto missions, but then under his tenure, it didn't happen. And there were a lot of sort of frustrations of the team thinking that they were on track, and then the leadership at NASA kind of changed their mind in various ways, and so it was ultimately later. Administrations at NASA that saw this through.
What has this cost so far, Alan?
New Horizons is a, by comparison to other outer planet missions, it's actually about a fifth the cost. It's about $800 million project spread over 15 years.
So it's not breaking the bank?
So it's a very small part of NASA's budget over those 15 years, less than 1%. But in the book, tells the story that when we were approved to do the project, we were given this budget that was so much smaller than similar projects had ever had that we really had to reinvent how to do this. And we had to take some risks, and we had to do some things that I think were ingenious, we developed a technique for hibernating the spacecraft that we talked about. Voyager took 450 people to run it. It was so complex. And New Horizons was a team of only 50. So we had to reinvent the whole thing. And now we've shown a way to get a lot more bang for your buck to do these projects at two dimes on the dollar.
Two dimes on the dollar. Also part of this whole story is the Pluto Underground that you were a part of, Alan. This was a group of, I guess, Pluto enthusiasts? I'm not sure what the...
Well, it was really a group of researchers, PhD researchers who were early in their career, graduate students and postdocs. Who wanted to see this through.
Yeah. And there was, an important dinner where, I don't want to make it more dramatic than it is, but where it seemed like this was the start of this whole New
Horizons.
That's
right. We were at a scientific meeting, the American Geophysical Union meeting in 1989 in Baltimore, Maryland. And many of us who'd been sort of talking about it and finding that there wasn't very much resonance against residents for it in the senior leadership, and largely because they would retire or maybe even pass on before you could build and fly a spacecraft all the way to Pluto, we realized that we were just going to have to do this ourselves. And there was a pivotal dinner at a little Italian restaurant in Little Italy in Baltimore.
Oh, I see the movie now. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where we kind of made a pact, It was men and women, but it reminds me a little bit of Band of Brothers, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
That we're going to go figure out how to do this ourselves. And that was really the seed. That was the genesis of it.
An email from Tom from Levittown. He's saying, wonder if your guests might know when the first ever photograph of a black hole is going to be published. David, is that on the horizons?
Well, that's not really either of our field. Like Alan was saying before when we were talking about the classification of Pluto, you know, planetary scientists are not astronomers who study stars and galaxies and black holes. What I do know is that there's sort of indirect visual evidence of black holes, and that we see stars orbiting around the center of the galaxy in ways that they wouldn't be if there wasn't some huge hidden mass there. A photograph of a black hole seems paradoxical to me, since one of its hallmarks is that it doesn't emit light. But, I mean, there is this event horizon where it's emitting all kinds of radiation as things fall into it. So I have to punt on the question beyond that because I'm not a cosmologist. I'm a planetary scientist.
Alan, let me ask you about New Horizons. So it's a billion miles from Pluto, or close to a billion miles from Pluto. What happens? Does it just keep going? Does it get swallowed up? Does it get destroyed?
Well, that's a great question, and people ask me that all the time. So the spacecraft is traveling so fast that it's literally escaping the solar system. And it's more or less coasting. And, of course, all the onboard systems are operating. But over time, it'll run out of power. That nuclear power generator will simply run out. And then it will be a derelict. But the interesting thing is that there's nothing out there in space that will cause it to wear away. You know, if it was here on the Earth and a machine stops operating like a car and you put it on a junk heap, it rusts and then it starts to fall apart. And in thousands of years, there's probably no evidence of it, right? But in the vacuum of space, out there in the very cold reaches way far from the sun, nothing ever changes. And so New Horizons is expected to not only outlive civilization, it will outlive the Earth. After the sun goes red giant and swallows the Earth in billions of years, New Horizons and the other spacecraft that have been sent out of the solar system will survive.
And how long will it keep continuing to send us data?
We believe we can operate it for 20 more years. We have the fuel and the power. And the spacecraft is very healthy. We're not using any of the backup systems. We talk about this a little bit in Chasing New Horizons, that it can continue to operate all the way out into the 2030s. In fact, I'm pretty confident that it can and it will. What I wonder is whether I'll be operating in the 2030s.
A question that hangs over probably all of us. Very quickly, because we're almost out of time here, your next project, you have several, Alan. One is the Europa Clipper mission.
Yeah, that's a big NASA mission to go and study one of these ocean worlds, Europa, which is a planet-sized satellite of Jupiter, which has an ocean on the inside and may harbor life. The Europa Clipper is the first mission dedicated to go study that ocean. And I'm on the science team, like many other scientists, and I'm pretty excited about this mission.
Well, it's been so much fun talking to both of you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having us.
You're very welcome. Alan Stern, principal investigator of the New Horizons mission. He's a planetary scientist. David Grinspoon is an astrobiologist. Also, the two of them are co-authors of this new book we've been talking about, Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. And we do want to close things out with some music performed by our guest, David Grinspoon. And this is a piece called Life Out There, Trip to the Sun, from the House Band of the Universe.